Hey, Los Angeles. Are you looking for unique 4th of July plans for you and your friends or family? LA's greatest rivalry returns to Rose Bowl Stadium for a July 4th edition of the El Tráfico soccer matchup as the LA Galaxy return to their original home to defend their turf against LAFC. Last year, a record crowd of over 82,000 fans were on hand to witness the Galaxy victory. That's July 4th at Rose Bowl Stadium. Guaranteed fireworks both on and off the field and a celebration for all of LA. LA Galaxy versus LAFC, the Rose Bowl edition. Tickets at lagalaxy.com/tickets.
Now, no opportunity wasted. I'm your host, Angelica Ross. We are making our way towards the end of March. Time is flying, honey. And Women's History Month is almost over, but so far this month, we have featured cis, trans, and non-binary women who are all making history in their own right. From Marianne Williamson, Jinx Monsoon, Andrea Jenkins, to Erin Axelman, and today is no different as we continue to expand on the spectrum of gender, especially at the intersections of Blackness, with today's guest, Trayvell Anderson, a journalist, critic, editor, podcaster, and author of the book We See Each Other that I had the honor of writing the foreword for. But before we get to my conversation with Trayvell, let's set the tone with a quote from Buddhism Day by Day, Wisdom for a Modern Life by my mentor, Daisaku Ikeda. Today is Monday, March 25th, and it says, quote, "The significance of Buddhism lies both in the discovery of the Buddha nature in all beings and in the establishment of a practical method for bringing that out so that human beings can derive maximum meaning from their lives. This reformation of the inner human world is what we in the Soka Gakkai call human revolution. It's especially relevant to modern civilization, which has long been trapped in a sort of spiritual quicksand. We can escape that quicksand by calling forth the supreme human potential available to each of us." End quote. Thank you, Daisaku, for that reminder. It can be very easy to sort of get caught up in the drama of daily life and daily civilization. But if we each at least go back to focusing on our inner state of being, what we are contributing to the environment, what we are contributing to the environment, and understanding how to take responsibility. Like Jill Bolte Taylor, I think, is quoted by saying, take responsibility for the energy that you bring into this space. Well, one of those ways that you can take responsibility is by addressing that inner state, having a continual conversation with your inner state, and being able to do something about it and uplift yourself. All right. So now what? A lot has been going on this past week, and I know the internet has been buzzing with the news that Miss Candace Owens was fired from the Daily Wire. But listen, I'm gonna be honest, I just don't care. I don't care about anything having to do with her. I don't care to know what she's thinking about. I don't care about her perspective on anything. I truly do not care. I've heard that she is problematic, and I think I've heard a few things, but I really can't tell you anything specific because I avoid her and her name like Beetlejuice. It's a few people actually like that. Speaking of another white trans woman with a severe case of white male privilege who shall remain nameless, had the nerve to go up and open her mouth again about trans women not being allowed to participate in women's sports, meaning they shouldn't be allowed to from this person's point of view, a person who apparently identifies as trans themselves and plays golf. with women. But anyway, when I first saw the that video of them on my timeline, I wanted to read her for filth. But I'm actually proud of my growth. The old me would have lit her up before I even thought twice about it. But she is just another one of those people who is just extremely desperate for attention and will say and do anything to get it. You're not going to get my attention, sweetie. Moving on. Now, some folks are trying to tap into this chaos as currency and will F around and find out that the rate on the currency exchange of chaos can cost you everything. I'm doing my best to stay out of the chaos. It's not easy because I was right there with y'all in the mess with Clay and AD on Love is Blind. Yep, and my dad called me about it, talking about why would Clay do that? I got him hooked on it because somebody got me hooked on it. And of course, the mess is continuing on Facebook and other platforms where Clay's ex-girlfriend then stepped into the chat. Now folks are saying AD got a sugar daddy, which I'm like, and? Because her last relationship with a sugar daddy, what does that mean? That she's not ready for marriage? I think we need to consult Miss the Slumflower Hour. If y'all don't listen to her podcast, y'all need to. I need her to step into the chat because listening to her podcast has affirmed me in my current phase of just not really being that enthusiastic about men. I'm just being honest. Apologies to any of the men out there that I'm talking to, been talking to. But if I'm being transparent, y'all know that I just have not been giving you the attention that I should if I were interested in building a romantic relationship. It's just right now, I'm just not. Call me Macaulay Culkin because I'm home alone and I like it that way. As an entrepreneur who is responsible for keeping these lights on, I also have to pay a small team of folks that work with me. So I don't have a steady check just coming every week. I am the steady check. So where I'm at right now is if we ain't talking about spirituality and Buddhism, if we're not creating art or music together, if we're not protesting this corrupt system together, I don't want it. Placing priority on cultivating respect, equality, and human rights for everybody is always good vibes with me. Now, I know some folks, it might seem like I'm too serious. All she want to talk about is free Palestine and fighting white supremacy and trans rights. Well, that ain't all I talk about. But you damn right. I'ma talk about it, especially around people that I don't ever hear talking about it. Like ever. They all up in everybody else's business on the internet, but can't use their platforms to uplift serious social justice issues. They scared of messing up their abusive relationship with Meta's algorithm. You know, anyway, to each his own. I'm sorry to hear that Kate Middleton is battling cancer. I truly am, but I definitely was not interested in playing Where's Waldo? Or Where's the White Woman? I was not playing, honey. I'm not interested. I'd rather talk about the things that are providing us with an insight into the current ills of our society, like HBO's new documentary, Quiet on the Set. Ooh, child. I told myself I wasn't going to watch it at first. And I could not brace myself for what I was about to watch, but then I remembered that I felt the exact same way when I first heard about On the Record, the documentary detailing the sexual abuse and assault by Russell Simmons, as bravely told by Drew Dixon, who is a former hip-hop A&R legend who had to give up her career at the hands of a rich and powerful music mogul who to this day is avoiding charges in Bali. And that's why folks were so just incredibly disappointed to see Russell Simmons post a selfie with Usher, fresh off the Super Bowl, who recently traveled to Bali and spent time, I guess, with Russell Simmons. All of this on the heels of folks' names being brought up and dragged into the allegations surrounding Diddy. People just finding themselves gravitating to unlikely losers. What did Cat Williams say? I don't know. Cat Williams been doing a lot. We gonna go on. But anything. One thing that watching both On the Record and Quiet on the Set taught me is that it's never just about one person. There are so many enablers of abuse and so many folks who just kept quiet about what they seen, what they heard, or what they experienced for their own varying reasons. But now, not even a gag order can keep the girls quiet. And I'm just glad that people are finally finding the courage to speak up and hopefully start to prevent some other people from experiencing the same abuse. Now, let's get into my conversation with my friend, trailblazing pioneer Andrea Jenkins, who is the first Black trans woman to ever be elected into public office in the United States. Sis, I see you. I might have to follow in your footsteps. Take a listen. Welcome to Now, No Opportunity Wasted with Angelica Ross. I am here with Trayvell Anderson. Now, wait, Trayvell, the pronunciation, is it something that we would like rush through and be like Trayvell Anderson? Or is it like something like Jack A. Harry would say, like Trayvell Anderson?
It's very Trayvell. It's very Jack Hay. That's what my mother would say. I answer to Trayvell just fine, but my mother has been getting on me lately to make people say it right. So
Now you know who, when you speak, you know whose voice you sound like to me.
Who?
Char Jocelle. And I know y'all be we just did the podcast, your podcast together. Yes. You know, but do you feel like maybe from y'all working together that y'all kind of pick up a little tones and stuff like that?
Absolutely. Char has had such an impact on my speech because of how she says things, you know. Yes. And so I've definitely picked up a lot from her. Absolutely.
Yeah, Char is someone, again, just speaking of just incredible people and voices to listen to. If you haven't heard it already, check out their limited series podcast. It was also named We See Each Other, correct?
Yes. We See Each Other.
Yes, and I was a guest on that podcast. I also wrote the foreword to Trayvell's book, We See Each Other.
Uh-huh.
We See Each Other. And when I tell you, there was a lot of me like, I know, amen. And I heard that like just reading along with this book. Because I feel like obviously we have very similar experiences of just being in the spectrum of Blackness, mm-hmm. let alone the spectrum of gender and, mm-hmm. and things like that. So what I want to ask you about to start off with, like, as far as your spiritual foundation is concerned, because in your book you talk about kind of following in your grandmother's footsteps and you know, going to church. Other people thinking that you were sort of going to follow in those footsteps and maybe become mm-hmm. a pastor and do those things or what have you. Talk to me about both the challenge that you may have faced navigating that religious environment, as well as the opportunity that being in that environment gave mm-hmm. you.
Yeah, you know, I grew up like many Black folks grow up, going to church 3-4 times a week. My grandmother, Dorothy Montgomery Holmes, was the pastor of her own church, God's Tabernacle of Prayer, Church of Christian Fellowship in Charleston, South Carolina. And I was one of those kids that, you know, I was just my grandmother's shadow. And so everybody thought that I was going to be a minister, a preacher. My nickname was Preacher Man. I was one of those kids that, like, participated in the youth revival and, you know, did sermons from the pulpit.
Me too.
You know? And it's interesting because I also know that, like, I've identified and known I was, quote unquote, different since 4 years old. And so knowing that truth but then growing up in this environment that teaches you in so many different ways how to show up in the world in a very binary type of sense was interesting, to say the least. I think in retrospect, I can say that despite all of the trauma and the difficulty and the issues that I had navigating that space, one of the opportunities that came out of it was, you know, learning how to survive, right? When you have no other option, right? Learning how to ingratiate yourself into a space, even take on, right, so many aspects of everyone else that you see around you as a means of surviving and navigating a particular space.
I'm almost wondering, because I understand from what you've said that your identity, you know, obviously has evolved and you've kind of like grasped that over time. But at that time and being in the church and in that environment, were you displaying signs of queerness?
Oh, so what's really interesting is, so there is a situation that happened that one might interpret as me exhibiting queerness when I was 4 years old. And it was a big problem in the family. And when I say it was the big problem in the family, I also mean it was a big problem in the church, because the church was, you know, primarily our family. And so the week after this incident happened, there was basically an exorcism attempt that, you know, happened. Like, I remember it very cinematically, like church being over. Next thing I know, the lights are out. I'm being forced to kneel in front of the congregation. Candles pop up all these different places. And then next thing you know, they're like praying over me, right? Trying to pray the gay away. So that's one of my earliest memories of church.
And that was how old?
I was like 4, 5, 6. Like, I remember it rather vividly. But it's really interesting because the Black church in particular is a very queer space, in terms of the fashions, in terms of the shouting and carrying on, in terms of the music, right? And I think I witnessed and I could identify these elements of queerness, these elements of like just pushing up against so many structures and systems of how we are supposed to operate, showing up in church, but I wasn't necessarily able to, you know, embrace them for how true it was for me, right? Like, I had to show up. I say in the book that, you know, I learned so much about gender in church, because the ushers, who were always women, did a particular type of thing, and the deacons, who were always men, did a different type of thing, and never did the responsibilities intersect, which is really interesting when you know the history of my grandmother, who founded her church because the church that she came into Christ in wouldn't let women into the pulpit. And so she started.
And how revolutionary and radical was that in that time, right?
Absolutely, right? But then to acknowledge and recognize that revolutionary aspect, but then to be in this space that is also reproducing in so many ways the same types of harms that my grandmother had to face and navigate, it ends up being this like really weird experience. But I talk about it as an opportunity because I think it ended up teaching me these survival skills in a really interesting way. Like, I think because of that time period, I was able to navigate the LA Times in the ways that I did. I've been able to navigate my career in the ways that
Let me ask you, because so does it, you went to Morehouse?
I did.
So, you know, I would say, like, I just know coming up, that was on one of my lists. That was, mm-hmm. like, on my list of, like, schools that I wanted to go to. But I think I eventually came to terms to myself that maybe that might not be the environment for me, because if I get it right, Morehouse is basically the brother institution to like Spelman. Morehouse is for, yes. is for the men, yes. and Spelman is for the girls.
Yes.
And you talk about in your book, We See Each Other, you talk about sort of Morehouse and mm-hmm. that aspect and sort of how those gender politics played out at the intersections of blackness and queerness and how it's allowed or not allowed to exist. And you talk about, I think it was the Plastics, you know, as a part like of the group that sort of like pushed those gender boundaries. I could not help but think about white institutions, white college institutions, like there's some very prestigious all-female, all-women, you know, college institutions, where I've also known trans men to have transitioned through that space and also in some ways still have an alumni connection in ways that influence their careers, help them, you know, be able to go through those spaces. I can't help but think about how drastically different that experience is for those who are on the femme presenting side, especially at the intersections of blackness. Can you speak a little bit about like how important you think it is or was and is for folks to continue to push those boundaries of the binary in spaces like Morehouse and Spelman?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I always say that you mentioned the Plastics. The Plastics was a group of students on campus who at the time were gender nonconforming in various different ways, right? They wore makeup, they carried bags, they wore heels. And they really were the first people that I could like reach out and touch, right? That were exhibiting some sort of transness, some sort of gender nonconformity, some sort of, you know, pushing up against these systems, particularly in a space like Morehouse, where it is not uncommon for a student to have a three-piece suit on just because it's Tuesday, right? No reason.
Right.
No real reason, but just
fanfare.
Because.
You know what I'm saying? Fanfare. Yes.
Absolutely.
And don't let the queer ones join in on the activity, baby.
Exactly. Right. And so it was like Morehouse is this institution that is like historically Baptist. It's all male. You know, it is all about brotherhood. In so many ways, like we have this thing called new student orientation, which is like the first week for freshmen, and they literally make freshmen. Well, my year, we had to run up this main hill in our campus. They don't make them run no more, but we literally had to run up this hill with our hands locked on under the arms of the men in front of us. And we had to chant, "I've got my brother's back." Right.
Right.
That is how intense the brotherhood is there. And so with the Plastics, you know, the campus basically passed an appropriate attire policy, a dress code. And part of that dress code made it, you know, inappropriate for students to wear clothing associated with women. Women's garb is what it was called. And so the Plastics were kind of implicated expressly by that particular line, right? Vibe magazine did an article called The Mean Girls of Morehouse, in which they featured that group of students. It was so drama-filled, honey, okay? The alumni base was up in arms. But that representation helped me access things that were, like, deep-rooted within me that I did not know were possible. You know what I mean?
Well, let me ask you this. Would you have chosen differently? And this is the reason why I'm asking this is because a lot of times people are faced with opportunities and you can see off jump. It's about to be one.
Yeah.
It's about to be a show and whatever. So knowing, I mean, obviously something in you knew who you were going into that space. And having the challenges that you've had and coming on the other side of that, from the opportunities and the challenges that you faced, how do you look at that in hindsight? How do you see that opportunity of your life in hindsight?
If I was the person I am today, making the decision of whether or not to go to Morehouse, I probably wouldn't. I probably wouldn't. Despite how I do think that going to Morehouse has been a benefit for me in my life, in my career, in terms of the community that I built there, both of queer and trans folks and folks who are not, but also the broader just influence that Morehouse College has in Black community, in other communities. I keep saying that if I didn't go to Morehouse and if I didn't go to Stanford for grad school, I wouldn't have the career that I have, you know, and I recognize that. And yet still, I don't think, knowing what I know now, that I would do it over again, because it wasn't great. And you talked about how so many folks like still have some sort of connection to like being alumni of these, so many trans folks have connections to still being alumni of these institutions. You know, my relationship to Morehouse is a complex one, because I think that space is important for the folks that it's important for, but I also know that it has caused so much harm for so many of us, who have moved into different aspects of our lives in terms of our identities that fall outside of that quote-unquote brotherhood mentality. But we are also still great representatives of the institution, and in so many ways I feel like the college is not interested, or at least has not been interested in grappling with that and acknowledging us and our contributions to the legacy that is Morehouse College as well, even though we, you know, do not move through the world as men. And so it's this push and pull for me. Like, I want to go back for homecoming and get my life like everybody else, but also I'm tired of, you know, feeling like I can't be part of the legacy.
I think that is an overall, for me, that seems to be an overall theme of Black queerness and transness, you know, being a part of the Black LGBTQ experience. I feel like the cishets, mm-hmm, have collectively tried to push us out of the legacy of our Blackness. That we didn't grow up in the same neighborhoods, that we didn't grow up listening to the same music, you know? So it was shows like, for me, like Pose, that when it was on, the soundtrack of Pose alone was bringing people from different worlds together, hearing Patti or, you know, all the things, Aretha, you know, all the things in the background. Mm-hmm. So I can't help but feel at a loss, you know, for what we have not yet been able to claim. Yeah. As far as our fullness of our Blackness. Now, I want to ask you, so one of the gifts that Buddhism has given me, is to understand, you know, I came from, again, the same similar places that you came from the church. And in my experience, I'll say from some of the folks that I was close to, I could see the performance of religiosity, and the performance versus the actual presence of the word, the God, whatever, in their lives. You know, my mom, you know, at one point, she's obviously became a better Christian over time, but, you know, my mom would be one thing in church, and then as soon as we get in the car, you know, cussing us out and, you know, whatever, like, sit your ass down, you know, whatever. And I mean, not that you can't cuss being a Christian and all those things or whatever, but I think that in a world that has been dominated by Christianity, I think one of the biggest flaws is the system or the organization not seeming to have real avenues of accountability for those who claim to be a part of their organization. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when God, we talk about Jesus and compassion, love, you know, thou shalt not kill, you know, and the Ten Commandments and things like that. And we see situations like Sibley O'Shea that was, you know, murdered in New York or New Jersey, I think it was, you know, after like having the time of his life, you know, enjoying Beyonce's renaissance. And yet people can claim or try to grasp at sort of their religious beliefs as excuses to why they treat people the way they treat people. And so one of the things that I'm trying to give to the listeners, because I'm trying to figure out the word.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Kind of, you know, if we need to name our fans anything, you know, and our listeners anything, I think that I would name them like action figures, you know what I mean, or action heroes, folks who are learning to take action in their lives and understanding that everyday people can take action, as history is told, can be action figures. So seeing spirituality for me, I will say, and I will just sort of input my perspective as the correct way to practice spirituality is having it be some sort of daily practice, some sort of thing where daily you are measuring yourself up against that which you say you believe in. You are not holding on to some sort of foolish pride when we talk about pride and just pride for the sake of pride. But we know pride can be foolish if you're not accountable to the things that you say you're proud of. So when we for me to talk about spirituality as a daily practice, for you, what is spirituality look like for you? And what are some things that you are practicing? Put a thing at the end of it. What are some of the things that you are practicing in your life on a daily basis?
Yeah, I think one of the things that, so my relationship to spirituality, you know, has waxed and waned over the years. I still consider myself sort of kind of to be a Christian, I guess. You know, but I'm not going to nobody's church house. You know, I'm not reading the Bible every day, you know. And so when I think of spirituality for me, I think a lot about ancestry. I think a lot about community. Right. And so one of the things that I think is a manifestation of my spirituality is just, you know, trying to do something every day in terms of showing up for other people. Right. Showing up for my friends, showing up for my family. And I think by doing that, like that's to that point of accountability that you talk about, you know, that's something for me that I think keeps me grounded, keeps me, you know, tethered to people in a very real way, especially with this type of work that we do. I think it's very easy to get, you know, high and mighty and like, you know, up on our horses and whatnot. So I think of that, trying to show up every day in some way for the folks that I say I'm in community with. I also think about, you know, I've been trying to build a meditation practice of some sort,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You know, trying to just take some time at the beginning of the day to just like be with myself, be with my thoughts, be with my intentions. You know, it's hard because, you know, I like to wake up and get the running.
We all do. But, you know, it's so important to prioritize that kind of time for yourself. Like in our Buddhist practice, we chant every morning and every night and in front of this scroll. And basically what we compare it to, the process to, is spraying Windex on a mirror and Nam-myoho Renge Kyo Nam-myoho, and wiping that mirror clean so that before we go out into the world, I'm clear on who I am. I'm clear on my value. I'm clear on, you know, what my boundaries are, what have you. And then we go out into the world and we get all the pollution of the world, you know, all the different things, but we at least try to cover ourselves with the best viewpoint of the day and of our lives and of our environment and of our circumstances. And then at night, also try to be clear so that we're not turning to our loved ones and the people who are in our lives when we return from the everything, and we're not projecting all of the pollution, you know, that we've brought into to the world. What I'm curious about with you specifically is that you have been able to carve a path for yourself. And again, I liken this to, in Buddhism, we have this thing called the parable of the medicinal herbs. And it's basically a story that highlights the fact that in a jungle where there's so many different type of life forms, it's really under one sky. So they're all being nurtured by the same rain and the same sunlight, but each finding a way to be poured into, to the capacity that they have and to grow and to find their path in the whole ecosystem of things. So when I look at someone as unique as you are, there's so many of us still trying to find our way, let alone through academic spaces that value various things. How in the world did you approach the challenge or opportunity of becoming a journalist in a space that doesn't quite value trans perspective or narratives?
You know, it was really interesting because I never thought that I would be a journalist. You know, I wasn't that kid that, you know, watched Oprah and was like, oh, I'm going to do that. I wanted to be Elle Woods in Legally Blonde. And so when journalism came into my life in high school, you know, one of the things I'm grateful for is that it showed me that I could have a voice in a written way. And that it could be impactful. Now, when I was in high school, I was writing pieces about how I wasn't gay and how I needed everybody else in the high school to stop talking about me behind my back. But
she was in denial. You know, she was in denial.
Listen, okay, it did not age well, okay, and that's okay. But, you know, it was really interesting because, you know, I went to grad school to get my master's in journalism because I felt like I needed some sort of like formal education, right? At Morehouse, I studied sociology. I worked on the student newspaper, but like it, you know, we were just making stuff up as we went with that student newspaper. And then I went to grad school and I realized that like, oh, they're actually trying to teach me things that I already know because we were making stuff up as we went in undergrad. But I knew very early on that it was going to be difficult for me because I knew I wanted to talk about Black people and I knew I wanted to talk about LGBTQ folks. I knew that from the beginning. And I had professors who told me that I couldn't, that I shouldn't, because of, you know, quote unquote, objectivity in the ways that we are supposed to show up in various spaces. And I ignored all of that and continued pushing my way. I ended up at the Los Angeles Times as my first like big person job out of school. And ironically, at that same time, that's when my gender presentation started to shift to a more femme space. That's when I started, you know, just trying on different language to describe myself at that time, while also moving through, you know, a white newsroom that is the Los Angeles Times. It wasn't easy. They did not have a support system in place for the journalists ourselves, but also for the type of coverage. Like I had to do extra work to get our paper to update the style guide as it related to covering LGBTQ folks because it had not been updated since the 90s. Right. Wow. And we all know how much shifts have changed in our community since the 90s.
A lot since the 90s. You know? Yes.
And so I have constantly always been at odds with some of those foundational principles of our industry. I remember getting in trouble at the Los Angeles Times, being called into meetings because I was tweeting out, you know, things that ultimately would amount to Black Lives Matter or Trans Lives Matter, and that being deemed a political statement, right? And not just, you know, asserting the humanity of folks, you know?
Wow. Yes.
And it was hard and it was difficult. One of the things that was my saving grace, I believe, was the work. You know, the work was good. It was getting awards. It was, you know, having all of this attention. And I ended up serving in a a role that I think caused a lot of shifts and caused a lot of improvements in that space, largely because I wanted to create a space where I felt safe and supported. And that required me to say, you know, the way that y'all are looking at our objectivity is white supremacist in nature. Or black folks, we just talk this way. I don't know what you want to get from that. This is just how we do things, particularly on social media. I kept getting in trouble because of my Twitter.
Well, you know, it's funny because social media, like as black people, especially as black queer folks, so many people want to be in the cool with what we say mm-hmm. and do that they will basically live in blackface in social media, whether they're using our black memes or whether Absolutely. They're using black people as their avatars and making people think that there may be a black account and things like that. So it's like, it's always with so many things, it's always problematic or whatever when we do what we're saying, Absolutely. What we're saying. And then when someone else takes our euphemisms, our sayings, our style, that mm-hmm. all of a sudden they find it an acceptable point. But you're right, like navigating that space when there's so much education that still needs to happen, even mm-hmm. on a platform that is supposed to be standing in a place of qualified to disseminate a certain amount of information. I want to ask you sort of as like a enveloping question of our interview and also just like of your book. And again, folks, if you have not, you definitely have to pick up this book. It is a key. I write the foreword, and I was even kind of nervous about just even how transparent I was, you know, in the foreword. But I think that it's very important for us, as you highlight in this book, to tell our stories. What I want you to tap on before we go is, what I know is that with your book saying we see each other and just you talking about how we've been depicted in media and film and television. But what I want to talk about and tap on right now is a little bit of what I talked about before. Like when I chant, I'm polishing the mirror so that I can see myself and my circumstances clearly. Mm. What I feel like we're in a space right now where unfortunately, a lot of people can't see themselves. Let's stop with the media for 1 second. Mm-hmm. I think that people, because of religion, because of the projections of their parents and what mm-hmm. their parents want from them, because of their experience in school or trying to fit in some sort of box, mm-hmm. that we have a culture full of people who cannot see themselves clearly. Mm-hmm. And because they can't see themselves clearly, they don't really even see other people's lives clearly and just scrolling on Instagram with ill-conceived perceptions.
Yeah.
How important is it for us to, as you say, see each other? And how do you think we're going to continue to make our way towards that from this mm-hmm. day forward?
Yeah, you know, I think when I think about this, I think that the answer lies ultimately in community, right? And so when you ask the importance of like seeing each other, and the reason why I named the book We See Each Other, I wanted to be clear about who I was talking to, right? Which is other Black trans folks, right? Everybody else, you can peek in, you can glean the wisdom from this, but this is about us. And I think when we hyper-focus on our communities and the folks that are around us, I think it makes this work of cultural change easier. You know, I've been saying that oftentimes, you know, folks think very from like an institutional or systemic standpoint in terms of all the violences and oppressions that we are all experiencing. And folks, I think, sometimes feel like things are just so much bigger than them that they cannot do anything about it. But when you begin to focus on your immediate community and you begin to see the folks in your immediate community, I think that's how we begin to have some cultural change. So if you in your local community, right, are doing what you can to show up for the trans folks, for the Black folks, for the queer folks, et cetera, in your local community, the folks who are down the street from you right now,
absolutely,
right, and I'm doing the same here and they're doing the same over there, that's how the shift begins to happen, right? And so it's so vital for us to see each other, because that is how we get to that promised land that we say we want to be at, in terms of how we show up in the world and us having the rights and the humanity that we all are naturally due. You know, there's that glad statistic that folks always say of, like, you know, I think the number is 70 some odd percent of people say they've never met a trans person. And what I like to say is they believe they've never met a trans person. And the reason they believe they've never met a trans person is because they have not created a safe enough environment around them for the trans people who already exist in their local communities to tell them their truth. And so how can we think on an individual standpoint about making the space around us safe for the trans folks, for the marginalized folks who are already there? Right. And I think that requires us to see each other. And I think in the process of seeing each other, we begin to see ourselves more and more.
Well, Trayvail, I see you.
Thank you. I see you.
And I'm so grateful for you. I'm so grateful for the ways that you have added context to our experience with this book. I am so grateful for, I can see in you, Monica Roberts, you know what I mean? And just the legacy of how important it is to get it right. Mm-hmm. I know when we have large platforms like the New York Times and even sometimes Time Magazine and other places who are willing to align themselves with a narrative mm-hmm. that is counterproductive to the human revolution that we need right now. We need for people to reinvigorate their humanity in the ways in which we treat and see each other. Sometimes that is even just the beginning, the opening that cracks the door, is being able to at least see me.
Yeah.
See that I matter, see that I have value. And so I just want to just say thank you that I see you, I see your value, and I can't wait to see how how your presence and value that you contribute to this space increases. I think your voice is so important. And just thank you for sharing and inviting me to be a part of this journey with you.
Thank you so much for everything that you do, for your example, for your, listen, I know you be out here on the front lines taking it, okay, from the people for us. And so I'm deeply appreciative of you as well. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you so much. Everybody, pick up that book. We see each other anywhere you download books. Get the audiobook. Listen, because I'm a big believer here. I got the book and I got the audiobook because I'm that kind of supporter, but also because I kind of read slow. So I, you know, like putting on the audiobooks, I get it and I get it fast. So there's no excuses. Not only do we want to read these books, but I am now also being accountable to also reviewing those books and making sure that we add those reviews on all the platforms, because those things are important to authors and writers. Thank you again, Trayvail, for joining me today.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you again, Andrea Jenkins, for just blazing such a bright path for folks like myself to follow. You have some great shoes to follow, and I intend to make you proud. So before we go, I just want to drop another Buddhist breadcrumb and point you to this book by my friend Tina Turner. Not my personal friend, but, you know, my friend in the spirit, my friend in Buddhism. She has this book, Happiness Becomes You, A Guide to Changing Your Life for Good. I got a chance to interview her before she passed away for Glamour Magazine. You can Google and check out that article online. But, you know, one thing I love about Buddhism is that it really is all based off of the Lotus Sutra, which is basically the Buddha's last teaching before he passed away. So, you know, he taught so many things, and there were so many schools of spirituality that were built around the Buddha's life. But the Lotus Sutra is seen to be one the like culmination of all his teaching, where he basically expounds that anybody, not just men, not just priests, anybody can access enlightenment and develop an unshakable state of happiness in their life. And they don't have to wait 10,000 lifetimes to do it. They can do that right now. And so that's all. There's so many beautiful passages in the Lotus Sutra. But what I love about it is that we have all these different books that you can get and read many of them for free at nichirenlibrary.org, where we have the Lotus Sutra that you can read for free. There's also, and you can search it, which is really great to be able to kind of really just search it and read different chapters. But also there's the writings of Nichiren Daishonins, volume 1 and 2, who is a 12th century priest who basically separated himself from the rest of the priests when he realized that they were on another page and really just looking for favor and, you know, prestige and religious routine of offerings and aligning themselves with the government and all these different things that really didn't have anything to do with true Buddhism. So he basically planted himself on the Lotus Sutra and considered himself what he called an envoy of the Lotus Sutra, and encourages all of us to have the same vow to in ourselves to basically live our lives with the Lotus Sutra centered into our lives. And he was willing to even be exiled. And even our previous presidents, Jose Toda and Makaguchi, were both in prison for their beliefs in this Buddhist practice. But what I love about this story and this legacy of Buddhism is that it's meant for each one of us to take it, and as a bodhisattva of the earth to teach. As the lotus flower is a flower that both blossoms and seeds at the same time. So we basically take that reflection as we are learning this practice ourselves. We also plant those seeds with other people. And so, you know, many people understand things differently. And that's why it's up to you. That's why it's so important to find a way for Buddhism or spiritual practice or whatever to speak your language. Tina Turner bases herself off the same exact practice, but those who understand her life and what she's been through, they might understand from her words of how she explains how this practice, how she's used this practice to change her life. She goes in a specific part of this book as well, and she talks about the 10 worlds. So remember, I introduced the 10 worlds and I talked about, you know, the world of hell, and that each one of these 10 worlds exists within each of the worlds. And that adds up to some math that ends up being like the 3,000 realms of, you know, there's all these different concepts. And again, I encourage you to check it out for yourself, sgi-usa.org. But each world has a positive and a negative side. So like I was saying, in the world of hell in a previous episode, the negative side of being in the world of hell is hopeless despair and the inability to see oneself and others clearly and being and having these self-destructive tendencies. Whereas the positive side of being in hell is these personal experiences of deep suffering can lead us to the desire to help others find their way out of their own personal hell and their own personal sufferings. You know, so the next world up is the world of hunger, which in the world of hunger, you know, there's a positive side to hunger, which is we have a hunger to achieve goals and to yearn to have more for our lives. But the negative side of hunger can be greed, can be hedonism and an insatiable desire, meaning you're so hungry, you're willing to eat your own. Your credit's so bad and messed up that you about to now mess up your son's daughter's credit, who ain't even graduated high school yet, but they got a social security number, but you need that whatever you want to buy with their credit. That's just an example of being so hungry that you're willing to eat your own instead of finding healthy ways and healthy ways of desire and hunger. That's why there's the yin and yang to everything. So listen, with that yin and yang, there's I wouldn't say good and bad, but what we as Buddhists say, we say suffer what there is to suffer, enjoy what there is to enjoy, but never stop chanting Nam-myoho-renge-kyo. And basically what that means is life is suffering. And I know that we have a tendency to look away whenever we see something unsettling. But I want to encourage us not to do that. When we see sensitive content come across our feed, and you know that it has something to do with genocide in the Congo or in Gaza or anything else, don't look away. Hit that like button and watch when you can. I'm not saying watch it in the middle of your bachelorette party, but don't distract yourself from what's going on. Let all of this call on your humanity to take action in whatever way that can make a difference in your environment. In our Buddhist meeting this weekend, we talked about how it all starts with one person. The actions of one person can make the world of difference. No opportunity wasted.